What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to Off the Chain, simply the best podcast in crypto. Let's kick this thing off.
Silvio Macaulay is the founder of Algorand and an Italian computer scientist at MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. In this conversation, we discuss the origins of cryptography, why a blockchain is so important, what Silvio thinks about Bitcoin, why he created Algorand, how the system works, and what is in store for Algorand moving forward. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I hope you do as well. Skirt, skirt! Want to know who has the best URL? Crypto.com. That's right, Crypto.com. They're a crypto platform with one goal, motherfucking mass adoption. That's why we're all here. We're trying to get crypto in every wallet. Crypto.com is helping people do that through buying, earning, lending, and card payment. Everything you could want at Crypto.com. Go help your boy out. Tell him Pomp sent you. Download the app or visit Crypto.com. Pomp's got you, always. Ever wanted to get into mining and didn't know how? Don't worry, your boy Pomp's got you. Everybody got some electricity and Wi-Fi. All you got to do is go to coinmine.com. You buy a coin mine. It's like an Xbox or a PlayStation that helps you turn your electricity into Bitcoin. That's right. You purchase it. It shows up at your doorstep. You pull it out of the box. You plug it in, connect to your Wi-Fi. 5 minutes or less, you're mining Bitcoin. All you have to do is control it from the mobile app they provide, and then you receive over-the-air updates that add new coins and new features on a consistent basis. Kind of like how Tesla does over-the-air updates and updates the car software. Just you're updating your coin mine. Consumer mining made easy. That's right. Go to coinmine.com, tell them Pomp sent you, and thank me later.
Anthony Pompliano is a partner at Morgan Creek Digital. All opinions expressed by Pomp or his guests on this podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Morgan Creek Digital or Morgan Creek Capital Management. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
All right, guys, bang, bang. Super excited about this episode. I've got Silvio here. Before we get started, he's a real Italian. I'm only an Italian American, so he immediately wins. But Silvio is also known as the father of cryptography. And so I'm super excited to kind of get through this. So thank you so much for taking the time to do this, sir.
Thank you very much, Anthony. It's a pleasure to travel together tonight.
Absolutely. Let's go through your background first. You were born in Italy, and kind of walk us through how you eventually get to the United States.
All right. So I was born actually in Sicily, spent 12 years, the first 12 years of my life there. Then the whole family moved to Rome, another 12 years there. And I decided to study mathematics. So I got my first degree in math. And then towards the end, I was exposed a little bit to computer science. And then I say, so, gee, that I think is the new math. And I think I really wanted to study that. And so I looked around and found Berkeley on the map as really the place to study computer science, theoretical computer science. And by the way, I was not wrong, Anthony, because among my professors, there were not one, but three future Turing Award winners. So, my analysis was right on the money. So I moved to Berkeley. I spent this amount, the first 6 months, learning enough English to communicate and to understand what was going on. And then I started diving into research and on algorithms and discrete math. And then I found a course from Manuel Blum, which was computational number theory with application to cryptography, okay? And so at that time, there were no academic cryptography courses. There was the RSA, was encryption system was invented, but there was maybe one more subject, that was about it. So I followed this course, and the last three lectures were about cryptography. That, I must say, opened my mind. And somehow, I don't know how these things happen, I got into me and with a lifelong friend, you know, Shafi Goldwasser, the notion that you could play poker over the telephone. How to say so? Gee, I think that is a challenge that I want to take. So we started working towards that, and somehow we found the first type of a solution, or the right encryption to enable to play poker by phone. And then we solved the problem actually a few years later. It was a tough nut to crack, but I was hooked. And then I stayed in cryptography for a long time, and I found that it's a wonderful field with a lot of application and can really help humanity to transact way more than before by keeping things private, what you want to keep private, keeping things transparent so that you can prove that things are correct without, you know, revealing why. All kinds of marvelous things, and I've been loving it ever since.
Got it, man. Look, you've got an awesome story, and obviously the move from Italy to Berkeley ended up proving to be pretty powerful for your career. Maybe help us understand, for those that don't know, what exactly is cryptography from your perspective?
Oh, all right. So first of all, let me tell you classically what the cryptography means. It's a Greek word, right? And essentially means a secret writing, because the original and only application was to transmit a message so that only the intended recipient can understand what the message means. And an interceptor of a message, whether it is you intercept a courier on a horseback, and or if you catch something over a modern computer network, if you're not the recipient, you should understand the least as possible. But then I started working on different angles of cryptography, and pseudo random number generation, and interactive proofs, and zero knowledge, and essentially is being morphing into adversarial computing. So in other words, any computation in which, you know, you have an adversary that you want to defeat, I think is a fair game for cryptography. So who is the adversary in an encryption? Well, if I want to send you a message, the adversary is somebody who intercepts it and he should understand nothing. Assume that, you know, you want to prove to me that something is true. We want to prove a theorem. Then the adversary is somebody who impersonates you and tries to convince me of a falsehood. Assume that, you know, you want to somehow to spit out output, you know, a pseudo random bit sequence, like zero and ones by generated by the computer, so that they are de facto totally unpredictable. The adversary is somebody who'd like to buy your sequence, right? So And on. So and very often, you know, adversarial computing is very powerful, because, by the way, you don't need to be a cryptographer to believe that adversaries are everywhere. They are, and you need to have to be secure if you want to transact more, expose yourself more with security. And very often, the best way to model a complex system is to assume that sooner or later is going to be seized by an adversary, because anything complex enough will start behaving as if there is a very determined adversary if you wait long enough and the system is complex enough. So it really is a way to help us to construct much more reliable large systems. Yeah. To me, cryptography is adversarial computing.
And so walk us through, kind of from a historical perspective, what are some of the hard problems that that cryptographers have been struggling with over the years that now are starting to get solved and unlocking some of the beauties of what we're seeing with blockchain and cryptocurrency?
Well, you know, the first problem, as I was saying, was encryption, right? Yep. And because encryption, you want to hide a message, but very often encryption was like an oil and vinegar, right? You shake them for a while, they seem to be that they are well mixed, but then you wait a second and the oil separates from the water, right? And I think that at that time it was a mouse and cat game, so somehow people felt that something was pretty good to encrypt, then the bad guys figure out how to catch up, then you do a little bit of step ahead, then the bad guys catch up. And so the first problem to solve is about making sure that no matter nothing can be leaked about the message. And that's actually is very hard, Anthony, because very often you don't need to understand the entire message. It's enough to understand if it is a praise or an insult, right? It's enough to understand that somebody is upset in this message because it conveys a lot of information. So how do you know that you can hide all kinds of partial information in a message? That was the first breakthrough. And after that, it was an avalanche of all kinds of things. A second breakthrough was, you know, zero knowledge. So let me tell you what the zero knowledge is. In the simplest form is that assume that I know something is true and I wanted to prove it to you, right? But I don't want to show you the proof. And you don't want me to say, believe me, this is true. So I wanted to prove it to you in such a way that at the end of our conversation, you know that whatever I'm saying is right, but you have no idea why, okay? And you say, gee, Silvio, that is a very esoteric stuff. Who cares about this? Well, you know, let me tell you that anytime that you use, you know, an ideal password system is something that, you know, you want to be able to make sure to prove it is you, that to have access to, say, to a database. And you don't want to when you authenticate yourself, an adversary learns to impersonate you. So you really want to verify that is you and not, however, learn how to impersonate and to learn to prove your identity. You don't want to enable an investor to do your identity. I think that was another breakthrough. And I must say, you know, I was fortunate enough to be part of this original probabilistic encryption, which is this way to encrypt the data with an absolutely without leaking any information. And I was also involved in the development of zero knowledge proofs. And the other thing is which actually played a role in whatever we are doing right now in blockchain right now, was pseudo randomness and somehow verifiable random functions, right? So that is the idea is that, you know, I want to have a function in which if you give me a number X, the function is associated to this X, associates to this X a random number, and you give me Y and I give you a random number, so much so that nobody can learn what the, after asking what is the number associated to X, what is the number associated to Y. You give them the answer all along, and nobody can predict even better than random guessing what the function evaluated a never asked number like, say, Z is going to be. And so and that is true even if I specify compactly what the number is, so I cannot change my mind about the value of this function. And yet, every time that I give you the value, you say, oh, gee, that is the correct value. And gee, I have no idea that this was going to be the correct value. So this is going to be pseudo randomness, you know, zero knowledge, probabilistic encryption. So where really the main engines of this revolution in cryptography.
Yeah, the way that I always describe the zero knowledge proofs is, especially to Americans, is when you're walking in a bar, normally they ask for your ID. And when you show them the ID to prove that you're 21, they get to see your address, your age, they get to see your hair color, your height, your name, you know, all these other aspects of your personal information. But really all they want to know is that you're above 21. They don't even need to know when your birthday is, right?
Exactly.
They could just say, hey, yes, over 21. And so it's the difference between revealing all of your personal information or just revealing the fact that, yes, this person is over 21, but they don't even have to tell you when the birthday is, right? And so you can imagine applying that to a whole bunch of different problems could become very interesting.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's a wonderful example. If you don't mind, I'm going to use it, okay? That is from now on. And yeah, here is another example of it. You know, so assume that you know, you are a regulator, right? And then you want to make sure that you know, some of the financial institutions of the country are not overexposed on a single asset, right? But how do you know? You can say, hey, I need to have, as a regulator, I need to know, show me your portfolio of investment, what you're doing. Bank one, bank two, financial institution one, financial institution two. But that is too invasive, right? all of a sudden, all you need to care or you care about really is, are we overexposed? Is there a systemic risk? Yes or no? And, you know, if I can prove it to you that I'm not overexposed to on any asset, that is good enough. And why should I reveal the rest? Everybody has zero knowledge enables you to, exactly as you say, to customize the amount of information that you need to reveal to be believed and move on.
For sure. And so, you've been a computer scientist at MIT's Computer Science and AI Lab. And then you've been a professor of computer science in their Department of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science for a really long time. Walk us through a little bit of the work at MIT and kind of, you know, what's the state of AI, machine learning, encryption, cryptography, et cetera, today? Like, where in all of that work that you've done over the last almost 30 years do you really see the kind of ground truth today versus maybe some of the dreams that people, would like to think that we are?
Well, you know, first of all, you know, once you mention at MIT, let me tell you that it is really a fantastic place and is really like a chamber of resonance. It really made me a better science. It emphasized my work in so many directions. It's really, the institute has been a wonderful place and the students are really even more so. I mean, everybody is very experimental, allows you to teach, you know, new courses that people never existed before. And I think that, you know, if you want, all these things are really synergistic because at the end, if you don't have, you know, algorithms, and if you don't become very sophisticated in algorithms, and where MIT has been a really a world leader, you cannot have a cryptography either, right? Machine learning is also has helped the cryptography quite a bit. Cryptography has helped machine learning by providing actually example what cannot be learned and so forth. So I think that everything, you know, is really synergistic. And so you need an institute like MIT to make sure that, you know, everybody contributes to everybody's field. And so somehow, you know, in my own work, which finally led me to blockchain, I was, I look at the blockchain as an intersection of three things. You know, one is, of course, you know, cryptography. Another one is distributed computation, and I was able actually to, because I worked in both fields, given my colleagues and the particular interactive environment at MIT, and I really put one and one together in my work on blockchain. So you need very often. We are in a world. The world is becoming, Anthony, more and more complex. And you cannot expect solution from a given single field. So you need to have, you know, a magmatic, volcanic environment, a very creative environment where many fields emerge and to find a real solution to our more complex problems of today. And blockchain is one of them.
For sure. Maybe tell us a story about the first time that you came across, whether it was Bitcoin, blockchain, crypto, right? Like, you've been so deep in the cryptography and encryption world. And then you kind of find this other application of it. Talk a little bit about the first time that you came across today, what we think of as the crypto industry from a cryptocurrency standpoint, blockchain or Bitcoin.
All right. So as I've been a cryptographer for decades and distributed computation too, Byzantine agreement and things like that. And then for the last few years, I was doing mechanism designs like auctions or designing auctions or with special properties. And then these are all ingredients of blockchain, but I didn't know. So finally, I came across, you know, the famous paper, right? The Nakamoto paper. And I said, you know, gee, wow, that is, I think that what we have here now, we have been the reinvention of gold, okay? Very nice also the terminology, mining. I thought it was right on. And I said, gee, that is a really digital gold. That's fantastic. I think, however, the gold is going to be enhanced if you allow actually to have, you know, more meaningful and nimble transactions with it. So I decided to say, hey, I want to help this ecosystem and to add also a way of making more sophisticated transactions on the blockchain. And so I decided, you know, I closed, locked myself for a few months and just asked my wife, says, what are you thinking all the time? So, and I come up with a new design, and that was the Algorand way of doing things. And what I did, taking a page from Nakamoto's book, I just put a paper, right, out, a white paper out on a crypto archive, which given my the right repository for things like this. And see, let's see what the community thinks. And one of the first answers that I got was actually from a colleague of mine in the system security, Nikolai Zelzovich. And he told me, gee, Silvio, I think that it's too good to be true, okay? Do you mind if we test it? You know, I tell you, no scientist should say, yes, I do mind, don't test it. So we ran a very rigorous experiment together with another postdoc who is now also in Algorand, and another student also in Algorand. And we rented a 1,000 big servers from Amazon, and we tried to simulate what was going on. And my oh my, you know, the theory was proven correct. And the system really scaled as we thought it would. And so all of a sudden, you know, I felt, you know, hey, we had the technology, now we have an experiment, how about making a company? So so I looked around and I found that some friends that actually have co-invested in the first round, which was Pillars, and Jamie Golsing, a very old VC friend of mine. And then he was joined by USV Ventures from New York, and we raised in a Series A, and then we put together a team. And of the original 11 members of the team, you know, 8 were from MIT. So it was it was actually I really felt at home. And then we were introduced to Stephen Kokinos, who is now our CEO. And Stephen was great. And so all of a sudden we started developing the team, not only in for the research arm, not only the engineering arm, but also the business arm. And so at this point, you know, when we raised, you know, more money, we did not want to do an ICO. Because, as you know, the legality of an ICO is in question. So we raised our money the good old-fashioned way by equity financing. In total, we raised some $66 million, take it or leave it. And so we had all the money to develop the network. And to and then just, you know, after developing all the network, testing extensively by ourselves, with our partners, and then the public testnet for a few months. Then last June, the Algorand Foundation launched the Algo from Singapore, and here we are.
Got it. And so let's walk through a little bit with what exactly Algorand is and how it works.
Okay, so the way I see it is the following. The fundamental, so there are two aspects to build a blockchain, right? One is to make sure that you have a sequence of blocks and nobody can tamper with the content of the blocks and nobody can tamper with the order of the blocks. Okay, so the blocks are contains the new transaction. But you know what the problem? All blockchains, they do the chain in the same way. They organize the untamperability of the blocks and the order of the blocks in the same way. The only problem is who decides what the next block should be. And that is really where a blockchain differ. And by the way, because if I do say in my blockchain, I decide the next block all the time, and therefore I have a tremendous power because I'm going to dictate what transactions are the only transactions that ever really ever happen in the world. And so proof of work does it in a way that, as you may know, was the first way, was a great way, but it consumes a lot of electricity. And when it requires a big investment to now in hardware and great consumption of electricity, when the cost gets very high, the system becomes more and more centralized. So proof of work generates, you know, typically you have a free mining pools who control the chain, which is not, you know, distributed enough. And in fact, the notion of scale, security, and being distributed, they were considered unsolvable at the same time. So the famous blockchain trilemma that Buterin, the founder of Ethereum, made famous, was saying that in any blockchain, you can enjoy at the most two of security, decentralization, and scalability. Now, if this were true, let me tell you, blockchains could not be that helpful, right? Because if I'm a new firm, say Blockchain by Design, and you are a customer and say, oh, welcome to Blockchain by Design. So you want a blockchain? Sure, just let me know which of these three properties you don't want. So you don't want security, is excellent choice. Really? I mean, if you have the security, without security, we have nothing. Says, okay, maybe I want to throw out scalability. What do you want to do with a blockchain? You know, to have run a private club with friends and family? No. But you cannot throw out a decentralization either, right? Otherwise, we have the world has plenty of centralized solution to almost everything. So the idea is to try to solve these three problems simultaneously. And that's what Algorand does. And that is actually, to do so, you need to put together this verifiable random function that I told you about. The idea is the following. Algorand block is decided, think of it in two magic phases, where the magic is replaced by mathematics. And in phase one, somehow by magic, for now, right? Because the mathematics we can talk about it later. A token among the circulating tokens is by magically selected, and the owner of this token proposes a block. End of phase one. Phase two now starts. Let's say 1,000 tokens are randomly selected in the network. Their owners, they form a committee who agrees on the block proposed by the first person. And they digitally sign what their that their agreement on the block has been reached. So that's how it works. And so you're going to say, by the way, why do you want to have two phases? Because when you select, you know, a token at random, I mean, we all know that, you know, there are some percentage of bad actors in society, and I don't see why a blockchain should be deprived of them. They have them too, and they own some token too. So let's say even if perhaps 1% of people are bad actors, it may be an exaggeration, but let's say that even we live in a very dangerous society, maybe 10% of the people are bad actors. If you select a random person to propose a block, one in 10 times, a random person can be a bad guy. And what can he do? He can tell you the block is X, he can tell me the block is Y, and can tell somebody else the block is Z, thereby generating confusion, right? You don't have a chain anymore, you have something ill-defined. So that's why you need the second phase, because now you select somehow, think of it like a committee of 1,000 people. Now, if 10% are bad people, and you select them 1,000, the probability that you have a dishonest majority among these 1,000, if you do the computation, is extremely small. So you are almost guaranteed that there is, you know, a honest majority in these 1,000 randomly selected people. And therefore, if, say, you see that 700 of these people digitally sign the next block is X, then you know that the next block is X, okay? That's how it works. So one person is randomly selected to propose a block, and 1,000 people are randomly selected to agree on the block. Now, the next question is going to be, say, gee, but in Algorand, who the hell selects this committee? Because the power is of the security of Algorand comes from the fact that in this 1,000 randomly selected people, there are there is an honest majority, but who selects these 1,000 people? Certainly, Anthony, is no secret that I don't select it, no, right? Nor do we have all the users of Algorand give a big party where they try to select collectively 1,000 people who then in turn select the block. That's, you know, we can talk and talk and never finish this task. So the strange thing is that in Algorand, there is 1,000 people select themselves. Now you say, gee, if 1,000 people select themselves, that is the big idea, that is a terrible idea, right? Because if people can select themselves, bad people will select themselves all the time and be part on any committee. But not so fast, because in order to select themselves, people must essentially win an individual cryptographically fair lottery. And that's where verifiable random function come in. Somehow 15 years later, to say, essentially, each one of us has a very simple lottery that you can run in the privacy of your computer. And if you win, you are part of the committee and you can say your opinion about the block, up or down. If you don't win, whatever you say about the block, nobody cares about your opinion. So the idea is that if you win, you actually get a winning ticket, namely a mathematical proof that you are part of this committee. And therefore, what you do, you propagate through the network the proof that your winning ticket proving that you are part of this committee and simultaneously your opinion up or down about the block. That's how Algorand works. Now, let me argue that this actually is both scalable, decentralized, and secure. So first of all, about scalability. How much does it take to run this lottery? And the answer is a microsecond. So that is very fast. In a microsecond, you know if you won or not. And if you won, you are one of the 1,000 winners. You just propagate your opinion about the block. And that's it. That scales. Now let's argue that this is decentralized. Notice, Anthony, that the winners are not just 1,000 random people every single time for every single block. It's not that I put in charge or Algorand put in charge 1,000 people who are in charge of figuring out the next block time and over and over and over again. It's just this block, 1,000 people, next block, a different 1,000 people randomly selected. So more distributed than this you cannot get. And now when you talk about security, well, assuming that I am a bad and very powerful guy, I am so powerful that I can corrupt any 1,000 people around the world I want, okay? I would love to corrupt the 1,000 people committee for the next block. But guess what? I have a problem. I don't know who this committee is because they are the winners of a lottery that has not even, that I don't know about it. So I don't know whom I should corrupt, whether I should corrupt you or some lady in Paris or another guy in Thailand. I have no idea. However, once the committee winners come up and say, here is my winning ticket and here is my opinion about the block, and they propagate this pair, now I know who they are and I can corrupt them immediately, given my great powers. However, what do I gain by corrupting at that point? It's a bit too late. Whatever they had to say, they already said it, and their winning ticket and opinion about the block are virally propagated across the network. And as powerful as I am, I don't have the power to suck out from the network their virally propagated messages, no more than, say, the US government can take out from the network a messages virally propagated, say, by WikiLeaks. So the system is secure because beforehand I do not know whom I should corrupt, and after the fact it's too late to corrupt them.
Skirt, skirt! Want to know who has the best URL? Crypto.com. That's right, Crypto.com. They're a crypto platform with one goal, motherfucking mass adoption. That's why we're all here. We're trying to get crypto in every wallet. Crypto.com is helping people do that through buying, earning, lending, and card payment. Everything you could want at Crypto.com. Go help your boy out. Tell him Pomp sent you. Download the app or visit Crypto.com. Pomp's got you, always. Ever wanted to get into mining and didn't know how? Don't worry, your boy Pomp's got you. Everybody got some electricity and Wi-Fi. All you got to do is go to coinmine.com. You buy a coin mine. It's like an Xbox or a PlayStation that helps you turn your electricity into Bitcoin. That's right. You purchase it. It shows up at your doorstep. You pull it out of the box. You plug it in, connect to your Wi-Fi. 5 minutes or less, you're mining Bitcoin.
All you have to do is control it from the mobile app they provide, and then you receive over-the-air updates that add new coins and new features on a consistent basis. Kind of like how Tesla does over-the-air updates and updates the car software. Just you're updating your coin mine. Consumer mining made easy. That's right. Go to coinmine.com, tell them Pomp sent you, and thank me later.
What, when you look out at the other blockchains that are out there, and somebody says to you, well, you've got Bitcoin that's got kind of the longest history. You've got a number of other blockchains that exist. Why is Algorand better? Or why go and spend your time building something new rather than working on one of the existing projects? How do you kind of think through on a framework basis, spending your time building something new versus trying to improve one of the existing blockchains?
Well, first of all, in our ecosystem, in Algorand, the Bitcoin is going to play a role, right? But the architecture is such that it does not allow you to do all kinds of things, you know, other sophisticated transactions as well as you want to do it. First of all, it produces a block in every 10 minutes. And if you want to make sure that there is no fork, you must, you know, wait for six blocks. So six times 10 is 10 minutes, times six is an hour. So you don't have the speed to have, you know, as gold is great, but, you know, the world is a big place. And if you want to transact, seven transactions per second is not going to cut it. So you need to have a different technology. And the other technology that are out there are very centralized. So if you, there is a technology that is called the delegated proof of stake, which essentially means that you find, you know, some 21 people who we consider them honest, and we hope they will continue to be honest, and you entrust them to select the next block for a long time. And is this decentralized? I claim it is not, right? So I think that if you believe so that the decentralization is crucial, you need to have a different approach. And that is somehow the approach we are going to do it. And by the way, we are focusing actually on democratization of finance. And Algorand is the first permissionless blockchain, which is a member of ISDA. And so we want to make develop a financial instruments that can be used with great ease by financial institutions and really the common man, right? That I think is really what we need. And let me give you one example. One is a very simple, but yet up to now unsolved problem. Like if you want to run a Dutch auction, the foundation, the Algorand Foundation has actually auctioned off at launch just 5 weeks ago, 25 million tokens with a Dutch auction on chain. So everybody, thousands of bidders all across the world, posted their bids. You can see your bids on chain, great transparency. You can see also the bids of your competitors, and everybody realizes what the when a fair price is reached, when you have really a price, the first price that clears the auction. So Dutch auctions are not a novelty, right? But right now, when are they run? Well, every government, including ours, right, the Fed uses Dutch auction to auction off, you know, bonds, U.S. bonds. But usually the people who participate to these auctions are, you know, very few in numbers and very and pretty much the same, you know, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, and so on and so forth. And so in some sense, is it fair that they really snatch all these bonds and then they sell it to all of us later at a higher price? I don't think so. But you need technology to, because it's very easy in a single room with the players convene to see what everybody sees, the price goes down and everybody sees the bids coming in. But if you want to do a Dutch auction on a massive scale, then you really need a very decentralized technology. And decentralization is actually crucial. Because if the auction were somehow organized, say, by one or two or few mining pools or a few centers of power, then I could in principle, I could corrupt them not to put bids above mine and snatch, you know, whatever is auctioned for a very low price. And nobody even could notice that there has been foul play, because these people could always deny not to have seen any higher bids. So I think that, you know, the ability to run the Dutch auction on chain with transparency, decentralization, and on a massive scale bodes well if you want to tokenize an asset. Maybe you want to, you're a build constructor and you want to not to sell your office, new office building somehow to a few billionaires who specialize in real estate, because otherwise they can make your price, their price. What you want to do is you want to allow for fractional ownership, and you want to sell it as a Dutch auction, allowing me or other people from even from abroad to bid somehow $10,000 or whatever, to in the hope to get a small piece of a building. So the bidders that they can directly access the auction are very happy, because this is the first time that this opportunity is given to them. And you, as the owner of a building, are super happy, because that is the time in which you are going to really realize the value of whatever you have created, right? So that's one aspect. More sophisticated things we are going to add to our platform now, essentially atomic swaps. We call them actually atomic square swaps. And these are atomic swaps which are really atomic. So let me break it up. Maybe in a swap, you have an asset that I want, and I have an asset that you want. Maybe you have money and I have a building and we want to swap, or an apartment, right? Or something like this. In a blockchain, I can transfer my asset to you very quickly. In Algorand, we produce a block every 4.5 seconds. So in 4.5 seconds, my asset is transferred to you right away. However, after I do so, then I have to say, Anthony, could you please so kind to now put on the chain and transfer to me the assets that I want? So when you want to do things simultaneously, it's much more complicated. And another blockchain have atomic swaps, which were not atomic at all. They were multiple steps. And very often think of it like a baby step, in which I take a little step because I'm afraid you're going to cheat me. You make a very small step because you're afraid of I'm going to cheat you. One step at a time, time locks, hash locks, a lot of complication to prevent that they can be cheating. We succeeded in doing it in a single transaction. So if a transaction gets on chain, we swapped. If the single transaction doesn't get on chain, I'm free to sell the asset to somebody else, and same for you. So these are, tokenization is one example, which I think I believe the ecosystem needed that, and to have atomic square swaps is another example that I felt that the ecosystem would be enriched if we have this. So essentially, if you ask among all various applications that I have for Algorand, the democratization of finance is one. And you may think of it like Wall Street 2.0 or Wall Street at every corner. You don't need to go. You can have, you know, all these sophisticated transactions available ubiquitously to everybody. I think that is the vision I have for Algorand.
Got it. And so what's like kind of the next two or three milestones that you're trying to hit here as you move forward towards that vision? What are kind of the things you're looking forward to?
So, one is a way to do name token and subchains in a way that makes a much more sense. One is smart contracts, which are very nimble and not the way occur in other chains. And another thing, by the way, is something that, you know, you not think right away, but is a way to somehow compactify the chain, because as the blockchain keeps on evolving, somehow the sides of the chain becomes huge. And at this point, very few people are able to store the chain. So if a chain is a terabyte, right, and you say, I'd like to join the blockchain, and say, yeah, please join, I'd like to contribute to generating the new block, because in a decentralized and really democratic way, everybody should be able to help in generating the new block. They say, well, download a terabyte of chain and then help us. you go, well, download a terabyte of chain isn't that easy. And it's going to take 3 months. And then I had to download a little bit more because I had to download whatever the chain has gone to in during these 3 months. So I think that, you know, storage of the chain is another problem that needs, started screaming for solutions very quickly. So I think that is another thing that we are going to do. And we have a system called Vault that allows you to onboarding new people to grow the chain very fast by giving you a very compact piece of information that allows you to grow the chain with the same power as somebody was there from the very beginning and has been storing the chain all along. So you receive a compact piece of information and you're ready to go. And by the way, you not only receive a compact piece of information, but also a mathematical proof, very easy and compact too, that the piece of information that you got is actually correct. Because otherwise you have to worry about it, right? And so that's, I think, that what we need in the chain. And
got it. And so as you look out, what do you think is the most important company in crypto other than Algorand?
Well, if you ask me, I think I have to say is Bitcoin. Absolutely. I mean, that was the main innovator. That is the one that, you know, really plotted the vision for all of us. I mean, I have a tremendous respect for Mr. or Mrs. Ove Nakamoto's. And I think that is the one that we should build on and improve upon.
For sure. What's the one regulation that you would change or improve if you could?
Well, tell you the truth, I think that we all love regulation and clarity on regulation, right? I think, you know, I don't mind regulation at all. I think regulation helps the market, but we need the clarity. Somehow the Algorand Foundation launched from Singapore because Singapore had a very advanced legislation and gave us a complete a set of requirements that to be met to be a currency. And we checked all the boxes and therefore we launched from Singapore. In the United States, regrettably, we are not there yet. So cryptocurrency are not barred, but you know, the regulation is not complete. Once in a while, we know if you do X, then you are a security. Okay, we don't do X, by the way. If you do this other thing, you are also a security. We don't do that thing either. But we do not have a complete list of whatever we need to do. And that is problematic because I really believe that blockchains are a very sophisticated technological product done right. And the United States is a marvelous place, and particularly Boston, the ecosystem, MIT, Harvard, BU, and all the other 20 universities we have around here to do it right. So it's a bit of pity, and I really hope that the situation changes and we are going to have a clear clarity in the regulatory environment in the U.S.
Got it. What is your most controversial thought in crypto?
I really think that somehow the fact that, that you really have to have what is considered a bit too libertarian is the fact that I really believe that we should lower the technology bar and the computational effort so that everybody can participate. I really think that this is really, in my opinion, what we should do. I think that, you know, we cannot live in a system in which everything is central, essential, and central. And then very often, you know, people abuse of their power, whether they intended to or somehow it happened to be. Somehow, distributed systems are inherently fairer and they are inherently more secure. It's enough of excusing that, we messed up with our customers, we abused of our centralized power, we promised not to do it again, and then, you know, there is going to be a next time, and then there is going to be another next time. I think we need the technology, but with the right technology, you really can allow to have this universal participation, which really is a country like ours, certainly something we should aspire to.
What's the most important book you've ever read?
The most important book I ever read, I must say, is Euclid's book on geometry. Okay, I think that was really what fascinated me. It brought him into the field. And, you know, I must tell you, because I didn't get into this, I was convinced that I wanted to be a humanist. And I attended a classical high school. And so I learned about philosophy, aesthetics, art, Latin, Greek, and everything else. And but at some point, maybe because it was Greek, all of a sudden they sneaked into the curriculum Euclidean geometry, okay? I must say I was fascinated by the fact that actually you could prove something from basic principles. And if whatever was true in your mind, you didn't even need to go out and measure it in the real world, because you already knew what was going to be. I thought to say that, gee, that is fantastic, the power of thought and the power of clear thinking. I think that was my book.
I love that answer. That might be one of the best answers we've ever had. Before I finish up and let you ask me a question to end it, we always talk about aliens, and given your history and frankly all the work that you've done on the cryptography and encryption side, I'm super interested in your answer. Believer in aliens or no?
I believe that is a very poetic part, or and both a poetic and religious thought of it. They really coincide here. I think that, you know, life cannot be contained, and life always wins. And so I believe that we are really part of a big world of life, and I'm sure that there are other forms of lives as well. And we really hope, by the way, that as we should be, that we are all respective of all forms of lives, you know, evolved or not, and because we never know, we may not be as evolved as we may hope to be, right? And so I think that, you know, we are not alone, and we have never been.
I love that answer. That's a great answer. What one question do you have for me to finish this up?
Well, Anthony, you know, you have a really an expert here. You have been a great a shepherd of opinion. You're creating a marketplace of ideas here. So, in crypto, how do you think the crypto market evolves? What is the way it evolves according to you?
Yeah, I think that there's two main investment theses that I've personally held, pretty much from the beginning. One is that Bitcoin is a very interesting and valuable store of value. And the idea behind that is really that people trust algorithms in almost every aspect of their life. And so the idea of trusting an algorithm or software with your wealth, at some point in the future is going to happen. And I think that Bitcoin is probably the best chance that we've seen so far for that to be pervasive globally. So that was kind of investment thesis one. And then two, probably a little bit more related to Algorand, is that every stock, bond, currency, and commodity would eventually be digitized, right? So this idea that we were going to change the way that we settled transactions and governed transactions on a global basis. I think a lot of people, you know, look at blockchain and they're kind of caught up in the, I'll call it 1.0 applications. Right, I can use a blockchain to do X or Y. But to me, the really big value creation is if you can disrupt the way that transactions are settled across multiple industries on a global basis. And so if you think of those units of value or units of account for stocks, bonds, currencies, and commodities, if we are able to change the way that market participants settle those transactions, I think that's a really, really big disruption to the world that we know today. And so that's the part where, I'm cautiously optimistic, meaning that I think there's a lot of people working on it. I think there's a lot of people who are working on like 1.0, 2.0 type solutions. There is likely to only be, call it 3 to 5 players today that end up surviving over the next 20 to 30 years. But I think that if you can get behind one of those 3 to 5 survivors, they're going to be worth a lot of money. And I think they're going to be pretty disruptive to the global ecosystem. So I'm super excited about it.
Thank you very much, Anthony. I like your vision. Thanks.
Absolutely. Well, listen, Silvio, you've spent literally almost the last 30 years of your life working on a number of different aspects of cryptography, encryption, etc. that myself and everyone else listening to this has benefited from. So from all of them, just one, thank you for all the work that you've put in. I think that, you know, you'll probably never get the credit that you deserve. But from all of us, definitely thank you. And then thank you again for taking the time to record this. This has been super fun. I really appreciate the explanation of Algorand. And I hope that we can do it again in the future and kind of get caught up on updates as you guys kind of continue progressing.
Thank you very much, Anthony. It's been a pleasure talking to you and to your audience.
Hey, everyone. Pop here. If you like this episode of Off the Chain and want to help us take crypto to the top of the Apple, Spotify, and other podcast charts, please do us a favor and rate, review, and subscribe. To review, simply go to the Off the Chain homepage, scroll down until you see the five blank stars. Taking 15 seconds to fill those stars in and leave a quick review goes a long way in helping us take the entire crypto ecosystem to the top of the charts. I appreciate you listening and see you next time on Off the Chain.